Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 710. Update on September 11th and related matters. This broadcast is being recorded on May 9th of the year 2010. Before we get into the program, please use the SpitfireList.com website. That's yours truly's website. It has all of my life's work up there for download for free audio, literary, and others. There's also a wealth of other information, a mini-library of old anti-fascist books for download for free. There is feed from a number of very, very valuable blogs and newsletters, the GermanForeignPolicy.com, Global Muslim Brotherhood Report, the analysis of the remarkable Lucy Commissar. Those all feed down the front page of the website. There is also a frequently updated food for thought section in which small articles and small elements of analysis are presented. When a new one is posted, and they're posted several times a week, they begin feeding down the left-hand side of the front page, and then eventually they go into the news and supplemental section. If you look to the right-hand side of the front page, you'll see Select Category. Just click there, and you can check out For the Record. You can check out the Anti-Fascist Archives, formerly RFA. You can check out the Miscellaneous Archive shows, lectures that I've done, and the aforementioned news and supplemental section, as well as the books. It is by far and away the best source, single source, for anti-fascist information, and it's all available for download for free. The only investment you need make is one of time. There is, however, a page you can click on to support the work that I'm doing, and if you don't like what you see, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. Now, we're going to plunge right into the subject material of the broadcast. As I've mentioned in the past, the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist organization whose importance could not be exaggerated, an organization that dates back to the period between the world wars, that was allied with the Axis, and then was utilized, and apparently, in despite of the fact that it's now engaged in war against the United States, is still being utilized by some elements in this country, political and economic, for purposes of, well, during the Cold War, it was used for anti-communist purposes, and now it appears to be used as a vehicle for trying to pry away the Caucasus or to destabilize the Caucasus in order to tease away Russia's petroleum-producing areas from Russian control, sort of a contemporary manifestation of the old great game of the 19th century. It was not a very great game. In fact, it stinks, and the implications for the United States are very grave indeed. In For the Record 706, in one of our visits with the heroic John Loftus, that, by the way, a broadcast entitled The Obama Administration as the Last Victim of World War II, we talked about the fact that the U.S. basically had a binary intelligence system, one for the Republicans and one for the Democrats, two CIAs in effect, and that this dated back to the World War II period when Allen Dulles structured the Republican CIA as a vehicle for literally covering up the profound collaboration between American power elitists, economists, industrial, financial, and political with the Axis powers of Europe, and also, frankly, Japan as well. That binary intelligence system continues to manifest itself. Elements of the State Department in particular appear to be very sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood, whom they see as some sort of vehicle for accomplishing, apparently, among other things, splitting the Caucasus away from Russia. It is unclear to me exactly how much the Obama administration really understands what is being done in its name. I noted even before Obama took office that there were indications that elements associated with the GOP, but that elements that also contribute to and financially support Democrats as well, appear to have been sort of positioning Obama in such a way as to associate him with some supposedly moderate Muslim elements, but in fact Muslim elements that were not only associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, but with Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, Talat Altman, and the other GOP bigwigs who were basically running dogs for the Muslim Brotherhood, the parent organization of Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the parent organization for the Afghan Mujahideen during the Afghan War against the Red Army, and again, as I've mentioned, an Islamic fascist organization aligned with the Axis in World War II. It was a very disturbing blog, although one that illustrates in stark fashion the what frankly to, I think, a lot of people, and this is not in any way meant to be self-righteous or judgmental, what to a lot of people is very puzzling about the Muslim Brotherhood and the U.S. stance toward that, because as the U.S. is engaged in a very real fighting war against elements of the Muslim Brotherhood or Muslim Brotherhood elements, a very real war in which American fighting men and women are being killed and suffering terribly. At the same time, as was the case in the Second World War, there are other elements of our power elite, elements of the financial and industrial and political elite, reactionary elements, I would say fascist elements, that are still allied with the Muslim Brotherhood and hoping to use it. And ultimately, I think the fallout, and that may be more literal than I could possibly explain, the fallout from attempting to use these Muslim Brotherhood elements against Russia and hoping to basically annex the Caucasus to the worldwide petroleum industry, well, that is not going to work. Russia is not going to let the Caucasus go, and it is to be hoped that this insane policy can be changed before it produces some truly devastating blowback against the United States. Time permitting, I will ruminate about that more later in the broadcast, but if not, all of the For the Record programs are turned into a written article-length description, so please use the description. This particular post is from Jihad Watch, a very worthwhile website, and this is from April 2010, specifically from April 12th of 2010. This is an article by someone who has no use for Russia, so certainly I don't think this could be handicapped to the right as a leftist track. It's a woman named Julia Gorin whose parents fled the Soviet Union, and as she puts it herself, she is something of a Russophobe, nonetheless coming from someone who has no love for Russia. Her warnings that American foreign policy, or at least an element of American foreign policy, being realized in the Caucasus. And in this case, basically, an example of inertia. This is a pro-Georgia State Department diplomatic initiative, and to a certain extent a military initiative, that was begun under the Bush administration and which appears to be being carried forward to a certain extent by State Department elements under Barack Obama. To what extent Obama knows about this is anybody's guess. Obama basically came into office with an impossible task, in my opinion, a bankrupt society, a depression, and two wars. Not too good. I certainly wouldn't want that job, but I think he's doing about as good a job as could be possibly done, given the fact that his task was impossible from the get-go. But boy, this is not good at all. So I'm going to plunge right in, and I hope that this will illustrate for listeners who find some of my discussion of the Muslim Brotherhood puzzling, because yes, it is allied with some elements in this country, and at the same time, it is absolutely opposed to what most of us, I think, like to consider America. We'll be dealing more with that in weeks to come. We're going to be visiting with the author, or perhaps authors, of the book Muslim Mafia about the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which has the reputation of being sort of like the NAACP for American Muslims. It is actually a front for the Muslim Brotherhood and essentially little more than a terrorist lobbying organization. It was an unindicted co-conspirator in the recent Holy Land Foundation trial, but more about that later. So as a stark illustration of the binary functions of the Muslim Brotherhood vis-a-vis American power structure, consider the following from Julia Gorin from the Jihad Watch website. More details on the Georgia-hosted Jihadi conference emerge. An analysis published Monday by Defense and Foreign Affairs offers some corroboration for the Georgia-hosted, U.S.-approved Jihadi confab in December, the mention of which seemed to upset some readers. Here are the relevant excerpts from the 16-page analysis, which is subscription only and therefore not linkable. Meanwhile, Georgia is actively seeking to exploit the spread of Jamaats, jihadist mini-societies in the North Caucasus, in order to go after the Russian pipelines in hope of ensnaring the U.S. into actively supporting a new confrontation with Russia. In early December of 2009, Tbilisi organized a high-level meeting of jihadist groups from the Middle East and Western Europe in order, quote, to coordinate activities on Russia's southern flank, unquote. The Georgian embassy in Kuwait, for example, arranged for travel documents for jihadists from Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states. There is a large and very active Chechen and Circassian community in Jordan dating to the 19th century that is heavily represented in the intelligence services and the military. In Tbilisi, Deputy Minister of Internal Affairs Laura Kabatnadze was the host and coordinator. The meeting was attended by several Georgian senior officials who stressed that President Saakashvili himself knew of and approved of the undertaking. The meeting addressed the launch of both military operations in southern Russia and ideological warfare. One of the first results of the meeting was the launch soon afterwards of the Russian-language TV station First Caucasian. The jihadists of the North Caucasus, including the Arab commanders in their midst, came out of the early December 2009 meeting convinced that Tbilisi is most interested in the spread of terrorism. The meeting was attended by, among others, Mohamed Mohammed Shaban, an Egyptian senior commander who is also known as Saif al-Islam, and who has been involved in Caucasus affairs since 1992. He took copious notes. According to Shaban's notes, the Georgian government wants the jihadists to conduct, quote, acts of sabotage to blow up railway tracks, electricity lines, and energy pipelines in southern Russia in order to divert construction back to Georgian territory. Parenthetically, it would appear that some of the jihadist elements took blowing up railway tracks to apply to the Moscow subway, and the outrage at those acts on the part of the Russian people and Russian power structure should not be underestimated, and it is just mind-blowing at one level and truly outrageous that those Muslim Brotherhood / fascist affiliated elements of our State Department appear to be giving the wink and the nod to the Georgians. One wonders whether perhaps there will be some sort of retaliation, perhaps Russian mob elements or Russian fascist elements, and there is a growing fascist presence in Russia. We'll take the insult and the shedding of innocent Russian blood to heart, and just might see to it that some of these Muslim Brotherhood elements wind up doing something in retaliation against the United States, which the underground Reich, the element that controls these State Department and reactionary elements, would then say, look at Obama, he can't control terrorism, therefore we need to bring back you-know-who. And you-know-who and you-know-what will be back in short order, despite the fact that after what George W. Bush and his associates did, and they pretty much destroyed what was left of the United States, ruining the economy, doing untold damage to the military and national security establishment, destroying America's image and diplomatic stance abroad, and pretty much corrupting everything they could get their filthy little hands on, and they had their filthy little hands on an awful lot in 8 years, you would think that there would be no way they could even think about returning to power, but they're good at ruining things, and they're good at stirring up trouble, and it's one of the reasons I'm reading this article. Continuing with the article presented here, The Post, by Julia Gorin, this again from the Defense and Foreign Affairs publication, continuing about this Georgia-sponsored jihadist conference. Georgian intelligence promised to facilitate the arrival in the Caucasus of numerous senior jihadists by providing Georgian passports and to provide logistical support, including the reopening of bases in northern Georgia. Russian intelligence was not oblivious of the meeting, however. Saif al-Islam and two senior aides were assassinated on February 4th of 2010. The Russians retrieved a lot of documents in the process. Moscow signaled its displeasure shortly afterwards when the presidents of Russia and Abkhazia signed a 50-year agreement on a Russian military base in order to, quote, protect Abkhazia's sovereignty and security including against international terrorist groups, unquote. A major issue still to be resolved is the extent of the U.S. culpability. Well, I suspect that John Loftus's analysis of the binary intelligence system and of the Obama administration as the last victim of World War II is to be taken very seriously here. I would note that as I noted in For the Record 642, I may have the number slightly wrong for off the top of my head, maybe 643, but the Bush administration in the waning days of its existence, no, it was after that, actually, I think it was in the 650s, but the Bush administration in its waning days worked out a defense agreement with Georgia. Well, if Georgia continues to screw with Russia as they have been, then you can bet that that is going to have very negative consequences for us. But I suspect that what we're looking at here is what I saw basically bad Jack Obama and binary element in the U.S. intelligence system, the binary nature of it. I do pass to pass the Obama administration appears to be clueless about some of the Muslim Brotherhood elements in the United States, but it's foreign and domestic policy is certainly not pro-jihadist by any stretch of the imagination. Continuing with Julia Gorin's analysis. A major issue still to be resolved is the extent of the U.S. culpability. The same analysis recalls when this misguided approach was used in the Balkans and outlines how, in order to not alienate Muslims while we tried to contain terror from the Middle East, we fortified terror in the Balkans and jump-started the global jihad. Initially, the U.S.-led Western intervention in the former Yugoslavia was aimed first and foremost to salvage NATO, and with it U.S. dominance over post-Cold War Western Europe, from irrelevance and collapse. As well, the support for the Muslims of Bosnia became the counterbalance of the U.S. confrontation with jihadism in the Middle East. Anthony Lake, U.S. President Bill Clinton's National Security Advisor, formulated the logic for the U.S.-led intervention on behalf of the Muslims. The U.S. national interest, quote, requires our working to contain Muslim extremism, and we have to find a way of being firm in our opposition to Muslim extremism while making it clear we're not opposed to Islam. If we are seen as anti-Muslim, it's harder for us to contain Muslim extremism. And if we stand by while Muslims are killed and raped in Bosnia, it makes it harder to continue our policy, Lake argued. That, in the process, the U.S. would end up partnering with, supporting, and arming the very same jihadist forces Clinton was seeking to contain meant nothing to Washington. The only thing Washington cared about was the image of a U.S. rallying to the rescue of a Muslim cause. Note that in the 1990s, the U.S., like Britain, permitted and facilitated terrorist networks to operate in Bosnia and Kosovo for the purpose of Serb killing, and, along with Germany, we trained Albanian and Middle Eastern terrorists in Albania. Sure enough, the same decade saw U.S. officials participating in a December 1999 meeting in Azerbaijan, very similar to the December 2009 meeting in Tbilisi, where, quote, programs for the training and equipping of Mujahideen from the Caucasus, Central and South Asia, and the Arab world were discussed and agreed upon, unquote. The mention of this meeting comes in as the analysis gives background on how we decided to support terrorism against Russia. By 1999, the U.S. had given up on reconciling Azerbaijan and Armenia in order to construct pipelines to Turkey, and instead Washington started focusing on building pipelines via Georgia. For such a project to be economically viable, the Russian pipelines would have to be shut down. Hence, in early October of 1999, senior officials of U.S. oil companies and U.S. officials offered representatives of Russian oligarchs, unquote, in Europe, huge dividends from the proposed Baku-Ceyhan pipeline if the oligarchs convinced Moscow to withdraw from the Caucasus, permit the establishment of an Islamic state, and close down the Baku-Novorossiysk oil pipeline. Consequently, there would be no competition to the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline. The oligarchs, unquote, were convinced that the highest levels of the Clinton White House endorsed this initiative. The meeting failed because the Russians would hear nothing of the U.S. proposal. Consequently, the U.S. determined to deprive Russia of an alternate pipeline route by supporting a spiraling violence and terrorism in Chechnya. The Clinton White House sought to actively involve the U.S. in yet another anti-Russian jihad, as if reliving the good old days of Afghanistan, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Kosovo, seeking to support and empower the most virulent anti-Western Islamist forces in yet another strategic region. By the way, as far as the good old days of Afghanistan, the landmark text Invisible History by Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald would serve as a very, very good primer in that regard. I did four different interviews with those authors. Continuing, in mid-December of 1999, U.S. officials participated in a formal meeting in Azerbaijan in which specific programs for the training and equipping of Mujahideen from the Caucasus, Central and South Asia, and the Arab world were discussed and agreed upon. The meeting led to Washington's tacit encouragement of both Muslim allies, mainly the intelligence services of Turkey, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, and U.S. private security companies, unquote, of the type that did Washington's dirty job in the Balkans while skirting and violating the international embargo the U.S. formally supported to assist the Chechens and their Islamist allies to surge in the spring of 2000. Citing security concerns vis-a-vis Armenia and Russia, Azerbaijan adamantly refused to permit training camps on its soil. Now, just to keep our, including my, head straight, let's remind ourselves that this exercise that Robert Spencer was good enough to let me engage in on these pages was not a defense of Russia. It was not meant to start an argument about how bad or how not that bad Russia is. The point is that foreign relations in a mad world require finding enough common ground with not-so-great states so that we can work together where we can work together. It is to minimize the messiness of things. Why, when we had Russia in its historically most malleable form, did we insist on provoking and provoking and provoking? Why did we make a bad situation like Russia worse when we had an opportunity to make it better? As with all problematic countries that we nonetheless find areas of cooperation with, we narrowed even those areas by dealing with the Russians in the bad faith that had been their trademark. Simultaneously, we moved away from picking the lesser evil in a given conflict and started siding with the greater. Well, I would suggest that the real guiding hand here is what is the Obama administration, notwithstanding, still in charge of the United States and much of the rest of the world, and that is what I call the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich that went underground and that will ultimately benefit from pitting the U.S. and Russia off against one another. And then who will be the last man or the last entity standing? Well, that will be the Underground Reich, which will bring those surviving elements into a state of subservience. Continuing with this analysis, Julia Gorin writes, "It's a surreal situation indeed when the actions of my savior country, by that she means the U.S., put me in the position of having to defend Russia, whose people my parents thank their lucky stars not to have to live among any more. I myself am a self-proclaimed Russophobe. I just had no idea how much more pathological America's Russophobia is. So for someone who is loath to visit even Brighton Beach, I find myself in a surprising position here, pointing out where we went wrong and where we shoved Russia back into old behaviors. Infuriatingly predictably, one of the comment posters suggested that the line I'm taking here is one that's paid for by Russia. That same tip, unquote, was offered to Robert by a fellow blogger in that tone of providing some friendly, professional, and cautionary advice, unquote. The likes of which I'm all too familiar with by now. One Wall Street Journal fixture advised me, quote, your views on this, the Balkans, are deeply misjudged. You're not doing your career any favors, unquote. Thanks. Good thing I don't have a career, then. By the way, this is Julia Gorin writing, continuing. It certainly would be nice if anyone paid me for anything I do, but it wasn't to be in this lifetime. Regardless, it shouldn't seem strange for someone to be pointing out that our foreign policy is being guided by people with a stronger anti-Russian agenda than an anti-jihadist agenda. And notice where this kind of thinking has gotten us. Take the past two decades of Western policy and media coverage in the Balkans, which were based on information that made its way into reporters' notebooks directly from the Ministry of Information of the Bosnian government, run by the fundamentalist Muslim wartime president Alija Izetbegović. The template was used again and again when politicians, reporters, NGOs, and human rights organizations dutifully repeated what was coming out of the KLA-run newspapers and other propaganda organs of the Kosovo separatists. And so, in service to consistency, having gotten into this hole, we've kept digging. With our Yugoslavia intervention, as the defense and foreign affairs analysts point out, we've ended up, quote, demonizing the Serbs and the whole of Eastern Christianity as a whole, unquote. Such that we've arrived at a place where the word Byzantine is now used to mean primitive or uncivilized. While the Muslim world and Islamic heritage represent the height of culture, tradition, and civilization. One interesting thing about the reactions to calling the U.S. on its aggressive alienation of Russia via, for example, the use of jihadists, is the sense of outrage and shock at the suggestion that America would support these violent groups, followed immediately by a defense or justification of such tactics, e.d. we should help the Chechens against the Russians, unquote. Meanwhile, these oh-so-incendiary allegations happen to coincide with overtly stated intentions and policies. See the late Senator Tom Lantos, for example, and his ilk applauding the creation of a U.S.-made Muslim state in Europe, which the jihadists should take note of, unquote, Lantos hoped. So again, I hope this article helps to shed light or to clarify for listeners what I've been trying to point out about the Muslim Brotherhood and the Janus-faced stance that the U.S. maintains against it. It is not only very similar to, but a direct outgrowth of, a continuation of, the policy of the U.S. toward fascism, where at the same time, again in the Second World War, American fighting men and women were heroically fighting the very real danger that fascism represented to America. At the same time, elements of our power elite, by the way, including the members of the Bush family, were working or siding with the very elements against which the U.S. was fighting. Something very similar, really an extension of that, is taking place today. In order to help gain an understanding of the history and operations of fascism, one could do no better than using the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. My entire life's work is up there for download for free, and it is by far and away the best website for information of this kind, so please utilize it. And there's also a page to click on in order to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like the work that I'm doing, well, there's no better way of supporting it than to use the Spitfire website. And one of the things that could ultimately be part of the fallout, and it's one of the things that I think is so brilliant about the Underground Reich strategy, an entity that is still in charge of the United States, having basically taken over in a rolling coup, one of the primary elements of which was the events of November 22, 1963, the assassination of President Kennedy. Ultimately, the sorts of horrible incidents such as the Moscow subway bombings that took place recently, these will do the same thing in Russia that they have done in the United States. Terrorism produces reaction, and reaction leads to fascism. There is a growing fascist movement in Russia that basically is displeased with the loss of Russia's influence and with the operations of some of these jihadist elements. An article with which I'm going to continue inside, too. Judge who targeted Russia's neo-Nazis is found dead. Edward Chuvashov refused state bodyguard despite death threats, and this is a trend that I think will be exacerbated in Russia by these sorts of terrorist incidents. More about that, however, in Side 2 of the program. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program 710, update on September 11th and related matters. This broadcast has been recorded on May 9th of the year 2010. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.